So welcome to the Standard Model. My name is Latham Boyle. When I'm around, if you have questions about the class that don't get answered during the class, you can feel free to either email me at lboyle. Well, maybe I won't put my email here, but it's lboyle at perimeter. My office is 330. You can also try me there. What is this course about? Well, this is supposed to be the summary of our best current understanding of the laws of nature at the most fundamental level. So basically, what are the most fundamental building blocks of nature as far as we currently understand them? And what are the rules that they obey? How do they interact with each other? How do they join up to form bigger, more complicated things, et cetera? Why are we studying it? We're studying it because humans love puzzles and they're good at them. And for the past few thousand years, they've been obsessed with this question, trying to solve this puzzle, and the fact of the matter is, it's the greatest puzzle that they've ever stumbled upon. It's really the greatest puzzle of all time. I like to think about it. I tend to keep in mind this analogy with the greatest jigsaw puzzle of all time. Greatest because, first of all, it's enormous. It's the sort of collectively being solved by all of humanity since the dawn of history. But also, another thing is just that it's been an incredibly surprising puzzle. As we keep putting more and more of it together, it just turns out to, it's like a puzzle where you don't have the picture on the box. You have to put it together, and only after you put it together do you figure out what it's a picture of. But then as you're putting it together, it just again and again, people have been surprised by what it's a picture of, and then they get surprised. They think they know what it's a picture of, and then they build more of the puzzle, and surprise, it's something completely different than what they expected, which, throws the previous patch into a whole new light. So it's been very exciting in that regard. And then the other thing is that, it's been this puzzle that has, as I say, it's something people have been interested in for thousands of years, but then something happened both in the organization of human society and also, not to maybe too oversimplify things, but in the birth of Galileo, but that is too oversimplifying things. But anyway, around the lifetime of Galileo, things really started to pick up speed. And ever since then, things have, humanity has been making much more rapid and exciting progress on this puzzle. Part of the reason is that ever since then, it's not been a static puzzle where you just have the whole pieces dumped on the board, dumped on the table, and then you're putting them together. Instead, there's been a constant drip of sort of new pieces falling onto the board, coming from new experimental or theoretical discoveries. So the name of the game and the course is to hopefully kind of, first of all, give you a sense of the part of the puzzle that has been put together, the part that seems like we feel basically, sure that those pieces are in the right place. So basically to get to know the standard model enough that you understand its structure, you can use it to calculate the things you would want to calculate, you know how to work with it. But then another big part of the course is to understand what are the great puzzles or mysteries that are still unsolved that it presents to us. So that in particular, we'll see it's full of various very striking patterns, some of which are really very obvious patterns that are staring us in the face, but and yet we don't know the explanation for them yet. And then there's also various pieces hanging around the outside of the board that look a lot like they look a lot like they should fit here or there or work together to add a little bit of extra content to the main body of the puzzle. And so yeah, we want to understand where the basic unsolved puzzles are and where the most what the most intriguing things are at the moment. So you know, another thing to say is that you know there's this course on the standard model, and there's going to be a following course on beyond the standard model. You know, if I was going to summarize the relation, you know, of course, one thing, the main thing is that this one is introducing the standard model, and that one is about beyond the standard model. But you know, what beyond the standard model primarily means is, you know, the hope that new particles and forces will reveal themselves experimentally that'll then give us clues about where to go next, and that is one that has been a very important avenue for making this, for discovering the standard model itself. And throughout the 20th century, that was a very fruitful avenue. And undoubtedly will continue to be, you know, in the future. You know, another aspect of the story at the moment is that, you know, since the discovery of the standard model in the 1970s, you know, there have not been or very few discoveries of new particles and forces beyond the standard model. It works alarmingly well. And so another aspect of thinking about it and how to make progress is the possibility that maybe instead of imagining that what we're looking at with the standard model is just a small piece of a bigger object, and we won't really be able to take that object seriously until we find the bigger object, you know, maybe the standard, you know, maybe the inability to find stuff beyond the standard model so far is partly telling us that we should try harder to take the standard model itself seriously, and maybe it has a structure that already is trying to tell us something deeper than what we currently understand about it. And so, in fact, you know, I think there has been very interesting progress. There was one very important piece of progress in that regard that was made already in the 1970s. But then there have been. Oh, sorry, I couldn't quite hear the question. Could you say it again?
Sorry. My speaker randomly decided to talk about Higgs. Uh-huh. Just ignore.
Okay. So hi, Gan. I think there's been very striking and intriguing progress and possible progress in that direction that I hope to get to mention in the final lecture or two if we have time. That's maybe what I wanted to say about that. Let's see. So you know, in very brief, okay, so, you know, our best current understanding of the laws of nature, the stuff that we basically know to be a good approximate description of physics within some regime of validity, is that there's gravity, which is described by Einstein's classical theory of general relativity, which so far successfully accounts for everything we see about gravity, with the possible exception of dark matter, which is an interesting possibility, is that some people consider, although anyway, an interesting possibility is that instead of that being dark matter described interacting by a general relativity, maybe that's a sign that gravity is not quite that Einstein's theory of general relativity is maybe showing some breakdown on those cosmological scales where we think we're seeing dark matter, but certainly in the solar system and in astrophysical systems that are smaller than the size of a galaxy, general relativity is doing amazingly well. And it may well be doing well out to the cosmological scale, and what we're seeing really is dark matter. That, I would say, seems like the simplest explanation of what's going on. That's a not fully resolved question, I would say. Or there's always the possibility that that's wrong. Okay, and so then there's the rest of the particles and forces, the electroweak force and the strong force and all the matter particles that interact via those forces, the quarks and leptons and the Higgs field. Those are all described by this other theory, the standard model of particle physics. That is a quantum field theory. It's a particular type of quantum field theory called a non-abelian gauge theory or a Yang-Mills theory. And it's a specific, that non-abelian gauge theory is a infinite class of quantum field theories. The standard model is some specific, particular non-abelian gauge theory. And so, we're gonna mainly be focusing on, we're gonna say a little bit about this part, but mainly we're gonna be focusing on the standard model, getting to know exactly what non-abelian gauge theory it is, what non-abelian gauge theory is, period, and then which specific one our universe seems to be described by. And then, as I say, learning to get to understand all of its parts and how they fit together so that one can work with it, but also so that one can see what the sort of most intriguing unsolved mysteries about it are. Okay, so that was all I was going to say by way of introduction. Now, this first lecture, actually, in the next lecture, we're gonna, if you want, dive into the physics, and in particular, I'll give an introduction or review of non-abelian gauge theory, introduction or review, depending on whether you have seen it before. But it's meant for people who it's meant to be an introduction. For the rest of this lecture, I wanted to take the opportunity to introduce a collection of mathematical definitions and concepts that'll be important to us later in the class, just so we're clear and on the same page about them, but also take the opportunity to sort of introduce this perspective, which I mentioned very briefly also when I was giving my, I gave a little blurb to many of you earlier this year, when I was introducing my research and possible PSI projects. I want to explain a sort of organizing principle that governs a lot of these mathematical concepts, and that's, I think, is a good thing to know about, but also will be a little bit of a theme later in the course, and in particular, will set us up so that I hopefully can get across some of the things these developments that I think are exciting that have taken place more recently. Here's one that undoubtedly you've all seen. So a vector space V, well, you all know what that is. That's just a set of vectors, or I just mean it's a set of objects where you can add two objects and the result is still in the vector space. Or you can take any vector V and multiply it by a scalar lambda, and you get another vector in the vector space. Putting those two operations together, that's saying you can take any arbitrary linear combination, lambda one V one plus lambda two, plus lambda two V two. That's also a vector in the vector space, lambda is the lambda one and lambda two are drawn from some field F, which could be the field of real numbers or the field of complex numbers, in which case we would call this a real vector space. If it's the field of real numbers or a complex vector space, if it's the complex numbers. Here, a field is the mathematician's meaning of a field. A field means a number system where you can add and subtract and multiply and divide, and the multiplication operation is also commutative and associative. Okay, so a mathematician's field is completely different than what a physicist calls a field. Okay, so far so good. So that's what a vector space is. So an algebra A, well, that's just a vector space with an additional property that you can multiply two vectors. So there's a bilinear product where you can take two vectors, two elements of A, and multiply them to get a third element of A. And the product is bilinear, just meaning that it obeys the distributive law with respect to the linearity, you know, addition and scalar multiplication, in the obvious way. And so let's take an example. The first example is the set of n by n matrices over the complex numbers. So this is MNC. That's the set of n by n matrices with elements in the complex numbers. That's an algebra. It's a vector space because you can add two n by n matrices with complex coefficients and get another n by n matrix. So it's a vector space. You can take linear combinations of two n by n matrices and get another matrix. But it's an algebra because you can also multiply two matrices just using ordinary matrix multiplication and get another matrix. So that's an example of an algebra. We call that a non-commutative algebra or a non-abelian algebra. An equivalent word for non-commutative is non-abelian. A word that I should have written here because it'll come up. When you say it's non-commutative, you mean the multiplication law is non-commutative. So matrix multiplication, AB is generally not equal to BA. But it's associative because if you think about matrix multiplication, the product ABC, it doesn't matter whether you put the parentheses around the first two elements and evaluate that product first, or around the second two elements and evaluate that product first. As long as you keep the matrices in the same order, those two expressions are the same. So that's associativity. Okay, good. So let's get to a fancier example of an algebra or a collection of algebras, which are this is example two. These are the normed division algebras. So these are the algebras. These are basically the four possible number systems where you can add, subtract, multiply, and divide. And there's a norm telling you the size there's a natural norm so that numbers have a natural size, and there are bigger and smaller ones. And a famous theorem is that there's only four of those. There's the real numbers, and then you double those once to get a two-dimensional algebra, the complex numbers, and then you can double those again to get a four-dimensional number system called the quaternions, which is referred to as H after the person who invented them, Hamilton, the same guy who invented the Hamiltonian formalism, for example. And then you double one more time to get an eight-dimensional number system called the Octonians. And then after that, the game is over. You can't do it anymore. So let's just get to meet these guys in a little bit more detail. Well, the real numbers, okay, you know them all, you know them, of course, but just to be a little bit pedantic about it, to set up the other cases more clearly. So in the real numbers, we start with a basis, which is a one-dimensional basis. The only basis vector is, we'll call it one. Okay, so the basis here only contains one element, which we'll call one. And then any real number can be just written as an arbitrary linear combination of those basis elements. Well, in this case, that just means it can be written as a real coefficient times our one basis vector. So it's, as I say, in this case, it's just being pedantic to call this a one-dimensional vector space, a one-dimensional algebra. Okay, but I'm saying that to give a clear explanation of the pattern for how these guys are related to each other. So let's now move on to the complex numbers, which again, of course, you all know. So to get the complex numbers from the real numbers, we're going to adjoin a new element I. So now the new basis for the complex numbers is the old basis, the basis for the real numbers. But then it's also all the old basis elements times I. So in this case, that's just, well, there was only one basis element before one. So we have one times I. So the new basis is the old basis element one, and then a new basis element one times I, which is just I. Okay, so now a complex number is just a linear combination of those two basis elements. So it's an arbitrary real number A0 times the first basis element plus an arbitrary real number A1 times the second basis element. And now to work with those numbers, of course, it's clear how you add them. You add them just like any vectors in a vector space. To tell you how to multiply them, well, you just need the rule to multiply any two basis vectors and get the result, and you're on your way. Well, you know how to multiply one with one, that just gives you one, and you know how to multiply one with I, that just gives you I, because you know one times anything just gives you that thing. So the only new rule you need is the rule for what to do with I, and the rule is that if you multiply that basis vector with itself, you get minus one. Okay, so now you're off to the races, and those are the complex numbers you know and love, but maybe described in a slightly different way than how you usually meet them. Okay, but it begins to pay dividends as we begin to think about the next case. Let's look at the quaternions here. So now to get to the quaternions, well, we take the complex numbers, and now we adjoin one more element, J. Okay, so now the new basis is the old basis for the complex numbers, which just had one and I. But then we also have to add the old basis elements times J. So now, these will become J and IJ. So now we have four basis elements, one, I, J, and IJ. And now it's conventional to rename IJ K. Okay, so K is just a name for IJ. So now a general quaternion is a linear combination of those four basis elements. So it's A0 times one plus another A0, A1, A2, A3. Those are all just real coefficients because we're looking at a real vector space here. I should have said that. So these are, this is a real, these are the four real division algebras. So we have a linear combination of one, I, J, and K. Okay, so that's a general quaternion. And now the only rule that you don't know yet that you need in order to work with them is the rule for how J works. Well, just like I squared to minus one, we're going to say that J squared also squares to minus one. And then I also need to tell you how I and J interact with each other. The story there is just that they anti-commute. Okay, so you may know this notation, this curly brackets, you know, square brackets ij means the commutator ij minus ji. Curly brackets ij means the anti-commutator ij plus ji. Okay, so that's what I've written here. And so that's equal to zero for the two imaginaries, I and j. They anti-commute with each other. So now in contrast to the real numbers and the complex numbers, you know, the quaternions are the first number system where they're non-abelian, they're non-commutative because I and J don't commute, but they are still associative. We still take all products to associate, meaning that the so-called associator here, ABC, which is the ABC with the parentheses around the first two elements minus ABC with the parentheses around the second two elements is equal to zero. That's just another way to say that the algebra is associative. So if you just take those ingredients, that J squared is equal to minus one and I and J anti-commute and that they're associative, you can work out that this nice little famous mnemonic device for remembering the multiplication law for the quaternions. So this just shows you how to multiply any two quaternions, any two imaginary quaternions. So the idea of this picture is if I take two imaginary quaternions like I and J, I go around the circle from I to J. If I want to multiply them, I go around the circle from I to J and get to the next element, and the next element is the answer. And if I went in this direction of the arrow on the circle, then I get the answer comes with a plus sign. So here I times J, I go around the circle, get to K, and I went in the same direction as the arrow. So that means it's equal to plus K. IJ is equal to plus K. Well, we already knew that. That was the definition of K. So to take another example here, if we took I times K, well, the next guy we would get would be J. So I times K is equal to J, but with a minus sign, because now we're going against the direction of the arrow on the circle. Okay. So anyway, so there you go. That's sort of what the quaternions are about. And in the final step here, we'll just do one more. So you can see how the game pretty much goes. We're just going to do as we did before. We're going to get the octonions from the quaternions by adjoining one new imaginary element L. Every time we do that, we see that we double the number of basis vectors, because now the new basis is the old basis from the quaternions, 1, I, J, and K. But then we have to also take, oh, by the way, this U sign here is a union, means the union of this set with this set. So we have to take the union of the old basis, I, J, K, with the new basis, namely all these old basis elements, I, J, 1, I, J, K, times L. So we get this set of eight basis elements, 1, I, J, K, L, I, L, J, L, and K, L. And so a general octonion is a linear combination of all eight of those basis elements. So that's what I mean when I say we have this eight-dimensional number system. And now the new rules are, okay, same as before. When we adjoin a new imaginary, the rule is that it squares to minus one, just like previous imaginaries did. That it anti-commutes with the previous imaginary. So it anti-commutes with I and it anti-commutes with J. So those both of those anti-commutators are equal to zero, in other words. And now the one new rule that happens. So far we've not had three independent imaginaries, I, J, and L. By the way, I'm using L instead of K because K was already taken up here. So K was already taken in the quaternions. So the new guy down here is, even though it's the third independent imaginary generator, I've named it L. So now we have to, the new thing we have to know is what happens when we have three different imaginaries all in a product. And the new rule is that instead of being associative so that you can move the brackets from one to the other. Now, if you have three different imaginaries, the rule is that it's anti-associative. You see here that if I move the brackets from IJ to JL without changing the order of those of that product, I get zero. Whereas all of the other products involving fewer than three of IJ and K are associative still. And so again, it's I recommend this exercise to see that these rules for how the quaternions are built imply this little mnemonic device for quaternion multiplication. And I similarly recommend as a little exercise, if you're interested, checking that these rules for the quaternions for the octonions imply this little mnemonic device called the Fano plane for how octonions are multiplied. So what is this mnemonic device saying? Well, it's supposed to be that there are seven lines here. So I'm making a mess. I'm gonna erase some stuff. So up here, this circle okay, I'm going to think of that as a quote unquote line, where it's a line where I've just taken the two endpoints and joined them to make a circle. And in that sense, there's seven lines down here. There's the three outer edges of the triangle. There's the three altitudes of the triangle. And then there's this circle in the middle. And all seven of those lines, each of them has three imaginaries sitting on it. And each of those is supposed to be wrapped up into a circle and treated just like the quaternion circle. Okay, so if you look down here, you'll see that for any pair of two imaginary octonions, they always uniquely lie on one of these seven lines in this diagram. And you can figure out, you know, what the product of those two guys is by following that line to the third guy and checking whether you are moving in the direction of the arrow on that line or contrary to the arrow on that line. Well, maybe I'll just do one example just to make sure we're on the same page. So for example, here, if I took KL times I, if I wanted to know what KL times I was, well, that's along the bottom line. I would go from KL to I. I would move along here and get to JL, but I would be moving against the direction of the arrow on that line. So the answer, in other words, is minus JL. Okay, so those are the four norm division algebras. As I say, they play a kind of governing role in many, many topics in mathematics behind the scenes. Although in many cases the real and complex part of the story is understood much better than the quaternion and octonion part of the story, which is in some sense running hundreds of years behind the other two parts. Okay. So here's the final example of an algebra I want to introduce/review, which are Lie algebras. Okay, so what is a Lie algebra? Well, it's an example of an algebra. So it's a vector space with some product between the vectors that gives, you can take the product of two vectors to get another vector. But in this case, the product, the defining property of a Lie algebra is that the product, which is written as a bracket like this, this is called the Lie bracket. This is in a Lie algebra, it's just a special notation for the product where instead of just writing AB, we write bracket A comma B. And of course, in physics, we're usually thinking about Lie algebras. We're often thinking about Lie algebras of finite matrices, and we just write out this bracket explicitly in terms of AB minus BA, where in this right-hand side expression, the product is just the ordinary matrix product. But that is, I want to say that what I mean to say is that that's not the Lie algebra product. The product that defines a Lie algebra is this product. So it's as if when I take two elements A and B, their product is the commutator or the Lie bracket of those two elements. And the defining thing about that product that makes it a Lie algebra are these two properties. First, that it is anti-symmetric. So A bracket B is equal to minus B bracket A. And then secondly, that instead of being an associative product, it's not associative, but it satisfies this replacement for the associativity rule called the Jacobi identity, which is that the bracket of A with B bracketed with C, if you then take that and add it to this term, which is just where I've cyclically permuted A, B, and C, and this term where I've cyclically permuted them again. I didn't say that very clearly, but if I take A bracket B bracket C and then plus all cyclic permutations of that, the sum of those terms is equal to zero. That's the Jacobi identity. So an algebra whose product has those two properties is called a Lie algebra. And when you express the Lie algebra, the bracket as a commutator like this, as just the difference between AB minus BA with respect to some other product which you assume is associative, then these other two relationships just follow. In any case, so mathematicians have classified about 100 years ago all of the classical simple algebras, and they come in three families here: SON, SUN, and SPN. So these are the special orthogonal Lie algebras, special unitary Lie algebras, and the symplectic Lie algebras. And so these guys, these guys will be important. The Lie algebra describing the gauge symmetry in the standard model is made up of a bunch of these SUNs. The gauge group of the standard model is SU3. Well, the Lie algebra, the gauge Lie algebra of the standard model. I'll talk about the groups in the next slide. But the gauge Lie algebra is SU3 plus direct sum with SU2, direct sum with U1, and then when we anyway, let me not. I don't mean to get into that right now. Actually, let me muzzle myself. So I just want to say here that these guys have been classified, the special orthogonal Lie algebra. What is that? Well, it's just the set of n by n matrices with real entries, so n by n matrices whose entries are all real, and that satisfy the property that they are anti-Hermitian, in the sense that x dagger is equal to minus x. Well, if the elements are all real, when I say x dagger here, you know, I just mean x transpose. So really, in the real case, x dagger is equal to minus x. It's just saying that x transpose is equal to minus x. These are anti-symmetric matrices. And also that the trace of x is zero, that it's traceless. And then there's SUN. These are the analogous Lie algebras, but with complex numbers. So it's very, very parallel. These are the matrices of n by n complex matrices that are anti-Hermitian and traceless. By the way, notice that if you take an anti-Hermitian matrix, if you take an anti-Hermitian real matrix and you take the commutator of two such matrices, you get another anti-Hermitian matrix. If you take an anti-symmetric real matrix, you take the commutator of two such matrices, you get another anti-symmetric real matrix. You can check. And similarly, if you take a anti-Hermitian complex matrix and take its commutator, take the commutator of two such matrices, you get another anti-Hermitian matrix. So these guys do indeed close under the commutator product. And the third class of simple Lie algebras are these quaternionic analogs, the symplectic Lie algebras, SPN. So this is very parallel. Again, it's just n by n matrices with quaternionic elements. And now again, they are anti-Hermitian in the sense that if you take their transpose and then you take the quaternion conjugate, I forgot to mention what the quaternion conjugate was on the previous slide, but remember we saw that with a complex number, of course, with a complex number, z is equal to a0 plus a1i, the complex conjugate is where you just take the coefficient of all the imaginaries, in this case I, and take it to minus itself. So the conjugate would be a0 minus a1i. So with a quaternion or an octonion, it's the same story, that you have a0 plus a1i plus a2j plus a3k. And now the conjugate, the quaternion conjugate of that is a0 minus a1 I minus A2J minus A3K. Okay, so that's all to say that in these symplectically algebras, these matrices are Hermitian, and now that's what the dagger means. It means you take the transpose of the matrix, and then you also take the quaternion conjugate, and then that has to be equal to minus the original matrix. Okay, and in this case, it turns out you don't have the trace condition because the trace of the matrix doesn't commute with the rest of the matrix. So you see the first example of a ubiquitous pattern in mathematics, that when mathematicians try to classify some set of important objects, very often it turns out that the classification works in some sense a lot like this, that you get a few infinite families of sort of normal objects. So these are these three infinite families. They're infinite because n here in these first three families could be any value. These could be the algebra of 2x2 matrices, but then there's another algebra of 3x3 matrices, and then there's another algebra of 4x4 matrices, SO4, and then SO5, etc. So these are three infinite families. And those infinite normal families have to do with, typically they have to do with the real numbers, the complex numbers, and the quaternions. But then often that classification leaves out a few special, weird, kind of particularly beautiful weirdos, and those then turn out to be related to the octonions, and that's the case here. So there's five exceptional Lie algebras which don't fit into the above three families, which are called G2, F4, E6. Yes?
There is a common confusion. My worst point out that when we study physics, we always put an I when we define the Lie algebra. So when we see when we see it, it's always defined as e to the I theta times whatever t, and then it's actually a Hermitian because we force it to be Hermitian, but that one is actually correct.
That's a good point. I was gonna mention that later, but let me just say that now. So in mathematicians' convention, you express these things as these various algebras as algebras of anti-Hermitian matrices, like we've seen, because if you take the commutator of two anti-Hermitian matrices, you get another anti-Hermitian matrix, period. You don't need to, however, physicists like to think about Hermitian matrices because then the eigenvalues are real instead of imaginary, and because we think of the observables in quantum mechanics as being described by Hermitian matrices. And so conventionally, we define the elements of the algebra, we redefine them. So if the mathematician's algebra element was called X, we call this thing, I X twiddle, and we work with this X twiddle, which is now a Hermitian object because we've pulled out an I. And then as a consequence, when we write down the, commutation relations, the how the bracket works in Lie algebra, it has to have an extra I sitting in there. So if we take the commutator of two guys, well, the commutator of two Hermitian guys is not Hermitian. It's an anti-Hermitian matrix again, if you check. So to get an equation that makes sense, you have to have I times some Z twiddle on the right hand side for that. So it's just a matter of convention, and indeed, we'll switch back. But anyway, this is the sort of mathematician's convention. It's in a sense, the more natural convention for various reasons. But like with all conventions, opinions differ.
About this classification of all the Lie algebras that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that they all fall into these categories?
How do we know that they all fall into these categories?
Yeah.
Well, there was a so the proof that that is true is too long to. That's the kind of subject of a. But there's a kind of beautiful theory due to Cartan and Lee and. I'm probably forgetting a key person who played a role in that. There's a theorem that any that the Lie algebra's court that any Lie algebra that is any compact Lie algebra can be broken down into can be written as a sum of these bits. So it's not that any Lie algebra is one of these in one of these families. I didn't say that very clearly. Actually, it's that any Lie algebra, any compact Lie algebra can be written as a sum, as a direct sum of these semi-simple Lie algebras, of these simple Lie algebras. And then plus abelian Lie algebras, plus additional U1 factors, which are the completely commutative the completely commutative one-dimensional Lie algebra. How you prove that? So it's some sort of it's more like a periodic table. It's like, you know, any chunk of matter can be broken down into atoms, and then the atoms lie in this list in the periodic table. It's like that any Lie algebra can be broken in a canonical way into pieces which cannot be broken down any further. That's what it means when we say they're simple. And those simple basic building blocks, the theorem due to Lie and Cartan is that it consists of the basic building blocks are these guys, these three infinite families and these five exceptional cases. And the modern proof of it uses so-called Dinkin diagrams, which we'll meet later in the course. I think I'm just going to be confusing if I try to sort of actually sketch the proof. I believe that's true. But you would take if you wanted to learn the proof. The classification of Lie algebras and Lie groups is usually the subject of like a semester course. So it's a kind of long but beautiful theory that leads to the proof.
What do you mean by the word classical here?
Oh, sometimes people call, yeah, sorry, thank you. Nothing to do with classical versus quantum, excuse me. This is a mathematician's terminology that they refer to some groups as classical groups. It's basically in contrast to exceptional groups. Classical groups are these kind of ubiquitous regular groups. So they include these three that I've mentioned, SON, SUN, and SPN. And then they would usually also include like the special linear group, the general linear group, some kind of very standard infinite families of groups, but nothing about classical in the sense of classical versus quantum.
So you said something about being the classification for when things are compact. Is that when the groups corresponding to the algebras are compact, or how do we know that when you actually
yes.
Brent's going to get a compact group or a non-compact group.
Well, so these guys all have a natural inner product on them, and if all, there's a so-called Cartan form, and it has to have all negative eigenvalues. I actually can explain this point later when we get into gauge theory, when I introduce you to the adjoint representation, but I don't think I can explain properly the criteria here for when they'll exponentiate to be a compact group. But that's what we mean. That is what I mean by when I say that they're a compact Lie algebra. Well, Lie algebra is just some vector space, so it's not compact. But then, as you correctly point out, it's that as I'll say on the next slide, when you exponentiate these Lie algebras, you get Lie groups, and so this is a classification of the Lie algebras that exponentiate to compact Lie groups. Okay.
Ask the question, and did you want to ask him yourself about the trees?
Yes. So we had the question when we were studying SU2, which was, I think, why the generators are traceless. So we know that they are, so they correspond to observables. But what does the traceless part mean?
So if you imagined taking matrices that do have a trace, if you included matrices that do have a trace and you exponentiated them, you would get unitary matrices, but not special unitary. So they wouldn't have determinant one. You would get an overall phase. Because if you imagine taking, so the trace is going to, because these are anti-unitary X's, the diagonals have to be imaginary numbers. And so the trace will be some imaginary number. And when you exponentiate the trace, you'll get that'll give you the overall determinant of the matrix. So if the trace is zero, the determinant will be e to the I zero, which will be one. And so that'll be special unitary matrices are matrices that are not only unitary, but have determinant one. Whereas if the trace was non-zero, you would get e to the I theta for some non-zero theta, the trace would be I theta. So that would be the determinant. If the trace of X was some non-zero value I theta, when you exponentiated that matrix, you would find that the determinant of the exponentiated matrix would be e to the I theta, which would not be equal to one.
Yeah, I think her question is that what's the physical meaning?
So the physical meaning of Hermitianic is that we have observables. Does the traceless property have physical meaning or physical implications?
Well, in different contexts, it does. I think that depends on exactly what context the group is appearing. So for example, in rotations, one place where you encounter SU2, for example, is in rotations. How spinners transform under rotations. Might that be where it was coming up? Because in that case, it's SU2 that is the double cover. Spinners transform under the so-called double cover of the rotation group, and that is SU2, not U2. If you included the trace, you would get U2, which is not the spinner extension of the rotation group. But I don't quite have a general statement about that, you know, except that, I mean, one thing to say is that, you know, an overall phase like that often in quantum mechanics is, you know, unobservable. Cause if you just multiply the wave function in quantum mechanics by an overall phase, that's unobservable. So, I mean, that might be something to think about but it really depends on context, whether that's the right interpretation. So I don't think I have a great general purpose answer. How pleased or displeased you're looking.
Oh yeah, I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Some kind of specific context, we can look at it there.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. I think I better. Okay. Maybe I'll just go quickly here because I'm. Well, maybe I should just end. I guess I'm over time. You guys have a. What's the feeling? Should I? Maybe I'll just end. Finish this stuff at the end of next time. What do you think, Gun? Or people in the class?
You are the first lecture, so if you make an example that we end on time, maybe that'll be good for this semester.
Okay. Yes. That's a good idea. The flip side is that we'll miss a little bit the punchline, but I feel like there's been a little bit of a technical slog leading up to a fun punchline, which we lose. But oh well, what can I say? Come back next time for the fun punchline. I apologize, I didn't get to it. We almost made it. Anyway. Yeah. So why don't I just stop there? And if people have more questions, maybe I'll just briefly say no. I will resist. I'm sorry. So yeah, let's stop there, and I'll hang around if anyone has any more questions. Now it does seem like I have you guys still pinned there, so you're really tempting me to just give the punchline. I mean, do I see correctly that everyone's not leaving?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. Okay, okay, it's 10:04 right now according to my clock. If I'm still going at 10:07, somebody has to stop me. Okay, so I was just going to say, you know, the next thing to introduce was this group, what was a group G. Again, I know you've all seen these. They're defined as a set with three properties that they have an associative product. So if you take the product of any three elements, doesn't matter where you put the parentheses, and there's an identity element one, such that, which sends any object to itself. And then any element G has an inverse G inverse. So the G inverse or G inverse G is equal to the identity element. Okay, and then in this class, we're often going to be interested in so-called Lie groups. A Lie group is a special example of a group, which is instead of being a discrete set of elements, it's a continuous set of elements. So it's like it forms like a smooth manifold. So just like space-time is a smooth manifold in general relativity, this is another smooth manifold. This is another type of smooth manifold, but in general relativity, you know, it's the space-time is not a Lie group. You can't take two points in space-time and multiply them to get a third point in space-time. But in a Lie group, it's a kind of manifold where you can do that. So you can take this element G1, this point here on the manifold, and this element G2, which is another point on the manifold, and their product is a third point on the manifold, G1, G2. And you know, the elements of Lie groups are obtained from the elements that we described in the previous slide of Lie algebras by exponentiating them. So if we had matrices on the previous slide, you could take the exponential of a matrix, and what you get is the element of G of a corresponding group. When X is very tiny, you can expand this exponential so that it's approximately 1 plus X, and you see that X just represents the tiny little tangent vectors to the manifold above the point 1, above the identity element. So the Lie group is the whole manifold. The Lie algebra is the tangent space to the manifold above the identity element. And so the classical simple Lie groups have also been classified. The classification is very analogous to the one we saw before. In the interest of time, I'll just briefly say again, there's just three infinite families, which are just the exponentials of the previous three we saw. So you can look more carefully at the exact conditions on your own to make it to go through it a bit more quickly. But you know, the bottom line is they're exactly parallel to one another, except that one involves the real numbers, one involves the complex numbers, one involves the quaternions. And then there are these five exceptional Lie groups, which are the exponentials of the previous five exceptional Lie algebras. And they all have geometric interpretations in terms of the octonions and projective planes built from the octonions. And that whole geometric interpretation has this idea of comes from this idea of the so-called magic square, which was discovered by Titz and Freudenthal in the middle of the 20th century, and is a kind of very beautiful idea, which we may have a chance to say a little bit more about in the last lecture. And then I was just on the final slide as a kind of bonus slide. That was all the real material I wanted to introduce for the rest of the class. I just wanted to, you know, list, you know, give a more of a sense that, I'm at 10:08 now. I have a whole bunch of different topics that are analogous, not just groups and Lie algebras, but many different topics where you classify them and they fall into a few regular infinite families, and then which have to do with the real numbers, complex numbers, and quaternions, and then some special cases that have to do with the octonions. So here, the one example I fleshed out here was about manifolds of special holonomy, and there's two that have to do with orientable or non-orientable real manifolds, and then two more that have to do with orientable or non-orientable complex manifolds, orientable or non-orientable quaternionic manifolds, and then two special cases. And then there's a whole bunch of other interesting things about classifying singularities and catastrophes, Jordan algebras, which are the observable algebras of quantum mechanics, the finite simple Lie groups, including the monster, supersymmetric Yang-Mills theories, and supersymmetric string theories, Hopf vibrations, et cetera. They all have this pattern. And so I just think that there's an important question, I think an interesting question, and a question which increasingly I think there's evidence that it's maybe relevant is, you know, it's as if, you know, when mathematicians classify things, they always have this pattern. There's a bunch of infinite families that are kind of the regular cases that correspond to the first three number systems, and then special cases that correspond to the octonions, the exceptional cases. And moreover, increasingly over the course of the 20th century, it was found that all these different things were very unified with one another. So, you know, when you classify two different things in two different topics, actually they're very closely connected, and the regular objects are connected that you find in one topic are connected to the regular objects that you find in the other topic, and the exceptional objects that you find in one classification are connected to the exceptional objects that you find in another classification. So it's as if mathematics is kind of organized into a kind of regular part, which has to do with the first three number systems, the real, complex, and quaternions, and a kind of exceptional part that has to do with the octonions. And I just think it's a very interesting question whether, you know, to what extent the laws of physics that in the actual universe we live in are drawn from or related to the sort of regular part of mathematics or the exceptional part of mathematics. And I think there are some very intriguing observations that suggest that it could be, you know, the latter rather than the former. But in any case, I think it's a very interesting topic that I hope to give you a little flavor for it in the last lecture or two.